Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
This is Reaganism, a podcast dedicated to exploring where the Reagan movement lives today. I'm Roger Zakheim, your host, director of the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C. This episode's guest is Secretary Jay Johnson. A native New Yorker, Jay served as Secretary of Homeland Security from 2013 to 2017, where he was responsible for a variety of issues ranging from immigration and counterterrorism to cybersecurity and managing responses to natural disasters. Before working at Homeland Security, Jay was appointed by President Obama to be General Counsel of the Department of Defense, a period of time where I had the opportunity to work with Secretary Johnson. In that position, he was one of the leading architects of U.S. counterterrorism policy, and he also co-authored a 250-page report that paved the way for the repeal by Congress of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which prohibited gays from serving openly in the U.S. military. He began his career as a U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, where he prosecuted several public corruption cases. Jay is based in New York, where he practices at the global law firm Paul Weiss, though I should note that he left his private practice four separate times to become a public servant. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the podcast, Secretary Jay Johnson, out of New York in Washington, D.C., back, I should say, in Washington, D.C., at the offices of the Reagan Institute. Really happy to have you here. Thank you for being here.
Roger, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
So I want to dive into this discussion by first talking about Washington and your place in Washington. And many know you as the Secretary of Homeland Security during the Obama administration. Obviously, that wasn't your first rodeo in Washington. You left your legal practice at least on four occasions to serve in public office. I can think of two or three times to come to Washington, D.C. But I wonder if you might reflect on your first time working in Washington, because I think for our listeners, they may be surprised in terms of what you were doing in Washington and maybe more importantly, who you were working for.
Sure. So first, my mother's family, my mother is a native Washingtonian. She grew up on Maryland Avenue in Northeast, and her family, her extended family, were all Washingtonians. And a lot of her family, her father, my grandfather, her aunts and uncles were all postal workers. They all found security, long-term job security in the Postal Service, and they were patriotic Americans. Every time I'd come to Washington as a kid to visit my mother's extended family, I had one or two or three uncles who had to take me to the Jefferson Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument on foot in the July heat. So that's where a lot of my Washington orientation comes from. When I was 19 years old, going on 20, summer of 1977, between my sophomore and junior year of college.
And you were where for college again? Morehouse, right?
Morehouse College. Between my sophomore and junior year, I had the opportunity to work for my congressman from the Hudson Valley of New York, Congressman Hamilton Fish. He was known as Congressman Hamilton Fish Jr. because he was the son of Hamilton Fish, the father, who was still alive, but in reality, he was actually Hamilton Fish IV. There were four Hamilton Fishes, okay, all of whom were in Congress representing—
Hamilton Fishes or Hamilton Fish? What's the authoritative
way? That's a good question. You better ask a member of the family. But he was the fourth Hamilton Fish to represent the Hudson Valley of New York State in Congress. Wow. And he was, frankly, a blue-blood Republican. And Hamilton Fish I served in the cabinet of Ulysses Grant as Secretary of State. Hamilton Fish III.
So they were New Yorkers, I guess.
All New Yorkers. Knew each other, right? Some distant family connection to the Canes of New Jersey and the Bushes of Connecticut.
So aristocracy, no less.
Aristocracy, yes. Hamilton Fish III was FDR's congressman. and they hated each other. You heard the famous phrase, Martin, Barton, and Fish, coming from Roosevelt. Fish was Hamilton Fish III. He served in Congress from 1920 to 1945. He was an arch conservative of, he was a Republican arch conservative of Republicanism at the time. So he was House Un-American Activities Committee, an arch staunch anti-communist, but he was also pro-civil rights. He commanded a colored regiment in World War I, sponsored anti-lynching legislation in Congress. And so he was pro-civil rights.
This is Hamilton Fish Jr.'s father.
Correct. This is Hamilton Fish III, who lived to be about 102. Wow. And then Hamilton Fish IV, my Hamilton Fish, was elected to Congress in 1968, served till 1994. He was
so right to Newt Gingrich. So he was in the minority almost the entire
time.
Well,
that's a story in and of itself. Okay. So he voted the party line on economic issues. He was probably a hardliner on the Soviet Union, on communism, but also pro-civil rights. Mm-hmm. He was a co-sponsor of the Civil Rights Act of 1991, I believe. He was a co-sponsor of the re-up of the voting rights legislation, sponsored legislation to protect the handicapped, and was big into immigration reform. Worked with Congresswoman Elizabeth Holzman.
So that legacy runs deep. Tell us about the impression it made on you as a young, rising college junior.
Ham was a member of the Judiciary Committee. He was a lawyer. And I came to town. And Roger, you know this better than me. When you're a young man working on Capitol Hill in the Rayburn House office building, you feel like you're at the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. And for a summer, that's how I felt working for Ham Fish. Now, Mr. Fish, as we called him, was a very low-key, soft-spoken, even shy person.
Sounds like a typical member of the House Judiciary Committee, doesn't it?
Exactly. Of a different period, obviously. Oh, okay. And he was a little shy and stiff in public. He would bring a type speech to a Republican picnic in Dutchess County, New York. But he loved his work on the Judiciary Committee. And by 1992-94, he was the ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee. He had a close brush in a primary in 92, and he had health issues by 94. So he retired in 94, just when Republicans took the House.
So it would have been him and not Henry Hyde.
And not Henry Hyde, who would have chaired the House Judiciary impeachment hearings of Bill Clinton. And I will tell you, Hamilton Fish would have had no stomach for it. Fate meant that he probably left the House of Representatives for him at just the right time. But it was from Hamilton Fish that I got my inspiration for public service. And I think I've tried to model myself after him in terms of the type of public servant that I have wanted to be.
So two follow-up questions on that. One, give me some of those kind of impressions and principles that you
voted adopted. By the way, for Richard Nixon's impeachment. He was one of six Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee who voted for Richard Nixon's impeachment. And I'm quite sure he did that without taking any kind of poll or sample of voter sentiment in his largely Republican district in upstate New York. I'm quite sure he voted that way because he was performing his constitutional duty as he saw it.
And you've written that it was something he was proud of, that vote. I mean, there was some fixture in his office. He didn't talk about it too much. Okay.
Yeah, there was a wall hanging in his office in Rayburn that was an enclosed case with a gavel from Peter Rodino and a letter. And my recollection of this thing, this is over 40 years, is that it was a photograph of him as he was voting yes for Nixon's impeachment. His father, Hamilton Fish III, was very angry at him.
Unhappy with that vote.
Unhappy with the vote, and said so publicly, criticized his son publicly for voting that way.
So, doing what he thought was right, irrespective.
To do what he thought
chips
was right.
Chips fall where they fall.
Exactly. The constitutional chips fall where they fall.
Maybe we'll get back down a little bit, but that was also during a time where President Reagan was in office. Any recollection of the interaction or impression of the Reagan Revolution sweeping into Washington?
So, yes, I have a very vivid recollection of that. I worked for Ham again in 1980 when I was in law school.
So you went back a second time.
Yes, I went back a second time, and I drove him around his district.
That's not the cushy law school job, you know, Columbia Law School, no, coming down and driving a congressman
around? It was an education. It was a lot of fun. You're right. I was not a high-paid summer associate that summer. But fall of 1980, I was a second-year law student at Columbia, and I had been a volunteer for Jimmy Carter in 1976. So fall of 1980, I remember the morning after the election of Ronald Reagan being shell-shocked. It was not just the defeat of the president I had worked for, it was a landslide defeat. Right. And as you recall, something like half the Senate got wiped out. And we had a Republican Senate that next morning, as well as a Reagan landslide. And I remember my thoughts that day.
Just remind you, you're on the Reaganism podcast right now.
Yes, I remember. No, but I will go on to praise Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, and give him the praise he deserves. I'm just telling you my thinking at the time as a 23-year-old sure. Democrat. An actor had been elected president. An actor who once said that pollution comes from trees had been elected president. I was shell-shocked. Mm-hmm. And my law professor that morning in property kind of sensed that we were all shell-shocked and took a time out from the rule against perpetuities to
what a relief
help put the election in its proper context. And I remember what he said. Sometimes he recalled how bitterly disappointed he was when Eisenhower defeated his candidate, Adlai Stevenson, and said, sometimes we elect people at the moment in the context of a certain time in history that turns out in retrospect to have been right for the period.
Wow. This is in Columbia Law School.
This is at Columbia Law School, Roger. And that was November 1980. And looking back on it, I have to say, I think he was right. Ronald Reagan, by almost all accounts, was a great president. He was a great president for the period in which he served. And I was proud to receive last year the Ronald Reagan Peace Through Strength Award. Something that in November 1980, I could never have possibly envisioned doing.
It's a fun thing, how the twists and turns. And in that Peace Through Strength Award, you were given that award by the Reagan Foundation because of your leadership in national security, both as your time, I guess, accumulated from the time as Secretary of the General Counsel for the Department of the Air Force to General Counsel of the Department of Defense during the Obama administration, and again, as Secretary of Homeland Security during the Obama administration. And, you know, maybe from there, we'll jump right into the really interesting national security problems you worked on and the way you've tried to forge consensus on these kind of complicated and messy national security questions. Everything from counterterrorism, the Obama raid in which you did the legal work to support that operation, to managing the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration. Why don't we start with the counterterrorism policies? Because that shift between, let's say, the Bush administration, Bush 43 administration, the Obama administration, there was going to be a correction in terms of the way the administration was going to approach counterterrorism. And you had to manage that process, everything from the way that we would prosecute terrorists from Guantanamo Bay to the way we carried out counterterrorism issues. Yet at the same time, you were willing to take on those who felt you weren't going far enough in making that correction. Taking a step back, what was the mindset that you kind of applied to carry that course to keep the country safe, but at the same time, make the correction that the voters asked for?
So what's interesting, and this is a little bit of inside baseball, you mentioned I was general counsel of the Department of the Air Force. That was during the Clinton administration. As I'm sure you know, at the service level, the lawyering and the civilian leadership at the service level is all what we refer to as organized, train, and equip. Right. When I was general counsel of the whole Department of Defense, I was also the lawyer for someone in the military chain of command, the Secretary of Defense, as well as being the lawyer for the whole Department of Defense that is involved in warfighting.
And of course, that Secretary of Defense was Bob Gates, the Republican holdover from the
Correct.
Bush administration.
Bob Gates and then Leon Panetta. Right. And given the period in which I served as general counsel of DOD, the thing that I was most preoccupied with, not preoccupied, you can't afford to be preoccupied when you're the lawyer for such a big department, but the place where I probably devoted the most brain cells was counterterrorism and the legal architecture that went into our counterterrorism efforts, from drone strikes to law of war detention at Guantanamo Bay to military commissions. And it is necessarily the case that when you're managing these legal issues, you have to work with Congress. And particularly around national security matters, when you're working with Congress, you have to work with both parties in Congress.
Which you embraced.
Which is how I got to know both Peter Levine and Roger Zakheim. And I learned early on with the reforms we got through Congress to the military commission system in 2009.
Which was highly controversial. In today's heat, people don't appreciate what a big political issue this was, that the Obama administration chose to prosecute the detainees in Guantanamo Bay with military commissions as opposed to going through an Article III court, yet it needs to be fixed up and meet the standard of that met your standards, right, and the standards of the President of the United States, President Obama.
Right. Well, fundamentally, Barack Obama came to office with a pragmatic, let's get it done point of view. He was not dogmatic about too many things. He came to office clearly with a progressive orientation and worldview, but was also a pragmatist. And so early on, we decided, after a very healthy, robust internal debate, to retain the military commission system. The JAG community felt very strongly.
These are the Judge Advocate Generals.
The Judge Advocate Generals in the Pentagon felt strongly we should retain the system, but reform the system. And what impressed me is the JAG leadership, those who are responsible for the prosecutions of these cases, believed that we should discard what is referred to as CID. Testimony, the possibility of extracting testimony from an accused taken as a result of cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment. The JAG community believed that that was not good policy. And that was reflected in the earlier version of the Military Commissions Law, the Military Commissions Act of 2006. And the JAGs wanted to strip that out because they felt that it discredited military justice.
And that's funny. We just came from the Reagan Defense Forum recently, and we had a number of tech barons. Stick with me here for a second. There'll be a nexus to what you just said, who participated in that. One of those participants is the president of Microsoft, Brad Smith. And I'm not going to give a direct quote, but the thrust of what he said was, if people only understood how ethically informed and how familiar our military is with the rule of law, both domestic law in the form of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, as well as international law, it would calm the concerns that you see across California and Silicon Valley and other tech pockets in this country, that our military is not only something that you can support and work with, but you would embrace.
Roger, I know that in a very personal way, and then we're going to come back to your central point. My son wears the uniform of this nation. My son is 25 years old.
Coast Guard, right?
Yes. Graduated college 2 years ago and could quote you passages of the UCMJ, which he was required to learn as an operations officer on a ship.
Not as a lawyer, is your
point. Not as a lawyer. He could quote you passages from the UCMJ, which he knows. But the point I want to make here, the larger point in response to your question, I learned early on that on anything around national security, the best way to get something through Congress, to achieve legislative change, is work from the center and build out. Not work from the extreme right and the extreme left and hope to bring other people along, but to work from the center and start out. And so, as you'll recall, central to the whole military commissions reform effort were John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Joe Lieberman, and Carl Levin, as well as your boss, Buck McCann, and Adam Smith, and Ike Skelton. And that's how we got it done. We started from the center, build consensus in the center, and work our way out to the life, to the right and to the left.
You personally would kind of commit that shoe leather to have those conversations. It probably made the minders in the legislative affairs offices of the White House and elsewhere uncomfortable. But you were able to build that bipartisan embrace or support or agreement.
Well, Roger, it's how you get stuff done in Washington. You know, that's how you get the people's business done. What coming to Washington is not simply a matter of posturing or staking out your extreme point of view and screaming at the other side. You have to get stuff done. And in order to get stuff done, you have to bridge the divide. You have to, and I'm going to use the dirty word compromise, which I think something even President Reagan understood, to get stuff done and to accommodate somebody else's point of view as well as your own.
And was that an asset or liability when you migrated from general counsel of the Department of Defense, where you're doing this, to the Secretary of Homeland Security?
It's an absolute asset. By the time I became secretary, I think I had a reputation for being able to work in a bipartisan fashion. And even when we'd have sharp disagreements about things, even when I had sharp disagreements with Republicans on issues of policy, if there is an underlying respect for each other, it takes the edge off and you're able to work together on other things. And so an example I will use from my days as Secretary of Homeland Security, there would be times when we'd need extra money for something not contemplated in the existing year's budget. And we'd have to do-
Was an appropriations bill didn't allow for something you needed to do.
Right, we'd have to do what is referred to as a reprogramming. And so rather than unilaterally declare an emergency and just take it from one pot of money and put it in another without Congress's approval, I'd go to Congress for my reprogramming. We need extra money for TSA because there are longer lines at airports. We need to hire more TSOs right away. I'd like to reprogram money from account A and move it to account B. And the appropriators would almost always agree because we made our case on the merits and they didn't want to hear from their constituents at home.
That they were waiting online.
That they were waiting online.
Well, it's good to have that too.
But we'd get it done. And
you do it in a fashion, your point, that wasn't unilateral, the executive having some dramatic interpretation of their power, but in a pragmatic fashion where the Congress was also had their input and
approval. We're dealing with this right now. This really is.
Because reprogramming is not exactly a constitutional process. That's extra constitutional or something.
Well, as far as you and I were concerned, it was entirely lawful.
Right. but
we're suffering through this right now. What I used to tell my lawyers in the Department of Defense, and I may have heard this from you when you were in armed services, if you take an aggressive stance or adopt a very aggressive interpretation of an authority, Congress is just going to take it away from you in the next NDAA. So what's the point? If you adopt an aggressive interpretation of a law, better be prepared that it's going to be the one time only that you get to do that. And sure enough, in this year's National Defense Authorization Act, there are fights over whether or not the president should have the authority to declare an emergency and move money out of the Defense Department and put it toward a wall on the southern border.
So we're going to get back to the
which
wall.
Is all very predictable.
We're going to get back to wall and immigration in a second, but it's 2019, and there's a rising junior from Morehouse doing his summer internship, his or her summer internship. Is there anybody going to walk away with an experience like you had, you coming from what seemed to be like a Democratic family and working for a Republican congressman and taking kind of a lesson of compromise, of kind of principled approach to public policy? Do you have hope for that?
It's easy to say that the Hamilton Fish style of politics and governing in Washington is gone. And every time I'm ready to conclude that, I do meet somebody in the halls of Congress who I didn't know real well, who seems to me to be a genuine public servant. It's easy to write off the entire Congress as overly partisan and bitter. not getting anything done. And that is much of Washington right now. But there are still a number of people in our Congress today who I think are genuine, well-meaning people of good faith. You don't always hear about them because they're not the loudest voices.
You don't get headlines for that.
They're not the loudest voices. And so it is entirely possible and entirely plausible that there is some Democrat from a Republican district somewhere working on Capitol Hill as an intern who's working for a Republican member of Congress who will then go on to be inspired into public service by a member of the opposite party.
I like that optimism. Well, characteristic of being in the Reagan Institute. It continues here.
Right.
Even in Washington. I want to jump to immigration in just a moment, but there's a question I wanted to ask you, and it's not scripted. So here we go.
The answer won't be scripted either.
You've just described a policy issue set dealing with detainees, immigration, and counterterrorism policy, and how you built support from the center. Guantanamo Bay was a very controversial issue. At the time. At the time that you're building this compromise, you'll recall that the Republicans passed a law, President Obama signed into law on multiple occasions, prohibiting the transfer of detainees out of Guantanamo Bay, yeah, and not giving the president what was at least publicly described as an important campaign goal, which was to close Gitmo. So I just wanted to get your take on how the White House and others who are on the political side viewed what you were doing, how you managed it, because you were obviously dealing with a set of people who were responsible for, and maybe for principal reasons, maybe for political reasons, denying President Obama a major campaign objective. Talk about how you did that.
Well, there are a few things in life that if I had to do differently, I would do differently. Or there are a few times in life where I look back and I say, gee, I should have done that differently, because any mistakes I've ever made, I try to learn from my mistakes. I think that, and as you know, in 2019, Guantanamo was still open. And as you know, since 2009, there hasn't been a single trial in the military commission system over the last 10 years.
So to translate that for listeners, the detainees who are in Gitmo, were in Gitmo since 2009 and have stayed there. We have not been able to prosecute them through military commissions process that you worked in the Obama administration to reform.
Correct, right. And the number of detainees the population is much smaller now. It's down around 50 or so. If I had to live life over again as part of the Obama administration, and I think President Obama, if he were sitting here, might say the same thing, I would have just done it. I would have just closed the base and transferred the detainees to a location where the security was sufficient without the one-year run-up, which allowed for the political opposition to form and solidify. We just do it.
I mean, before Congress passed the prohibition, when it was still a discretionary opportunity for the administration
to do
that.
And as you recall, the prohibitions were not passed for some time. But I think if we had to live life over again, we probably would have just – now, it would have been difficult to make all that happen during a transition period. But I think if we had to live life over again, the goal of closing Gitmo is still one that I would have supported, particularly given the expense now 10 years later. But I would have done it differently. I would have, without the one-year run-up, because that was that enabled the political opposition to put into law something against what the commander-in-chief typically has the authority to do, which is to move military detainees from one place to another. That is well within a military commander-in-chief's authority to do.
And it was a couple of years, that period of time, where the Democrats had a majority in the House, and of course that
And the proponents of Article 3, you know, trials in civilian courts, are right to point out that every terrorist from the battlefield in Afghanistan who was picked up and captured and prosecuted in an Article 3 court has long been convicted and is now serving a sentence versus the law of war pretrial detention we have at Guantanamo.
Yeah. Okay, let's shift to perhaps even weightier topics. And your time as Secretary of Homeland Security, what you learned about immigration. And there's a record there that you hold up and refer to in terms of managing illegal entry into this country. You recently, as recent as July, you wrote an op-ed, I believe in the Washington Post, where you've talked for some straight talk on immigration, which if you read it closely, it not only seems to critique the current occupant of the White House and President Trump's approach to immigration, but perhaps the approach of the left as well in terms of their reaction to President Trump and his wall. Would you mind revisiting that? And for those who didn't read it, kind of go unpack some of the calls to action that were in that piece and what that straight talk was.
Well, first, this is a product of our primary system. In the phase of a presidential election where candidates are seeking to appeal to primary voters and claw their way into double digits, perhaps, they take positions that are never going to be sellable to the American public at large. The American public at large, and let's not forget this, want secure borders. Very often lost in the immigration debate where you have loud voices on the right and the left, is the broad consensus across the American public. The American public, I believes in treating people, including immigrants, humanely and fairly. We are a nation of immigrants, as President Reagan knew, but we also want secure borders. If you go to Laredo, Texas, which is something like 85% Hispanic.
Which you did as Secretary of Homeland Security.
Yes, and something like 80% Democratic. And you ask the local congressman there, Henry Cuellar, he will tell you these people want secure borders. They believe in treating people fairly. They believe in taking care of the dreamers, the DACA class, but they want secure borders. You cannot have, and I know this from owning this problem for 3 years, you cannot have a secure border if you deprioritize for deportation those apprehended at the border. You cannot have a secure border if you say to people, in effect, you've crossed the border illegally, welcome to the United States, you get to stay here as long as you don't commit a crime. You cannot have a immigration enforcement policy where you only deport people if they commit a crime.
That's what Republicans call open borders, right?
That's what Republicans call open borders. Nor can you have an effective border security policy if you decriminalize crossing our southern border, because you are now, the fact is we rarely prosecute criminally anyone who crosses the border for the first time. But if you publicly pronounce that we are hereby decriminalizing something, by the way, our Congress would never do, but you cannot publicly pronounce we are hereby decriminalizing crossing our border illegally and try to maintain control of the border, because you're sending the message, we don't take this seriously anymore.
And what you're describing was your tenure as Secretary of Homeland Security. What you're describing is what happened under the Obama administration.
I will point out, you know, this past fiscal year, we had over 800,000 apprehensions on our southern border, the largest in over a decade. My tenure, my second year in office, we had the lowest number of apprehensions since the 1970s. So I think we were not perfect, we made our mistakes, but that's not too shabby.
When you say apprehensions at the border, right, that if the number is low, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're letting people in, right? You're saying the opposite, right? That the flow isn't going through, that you're doing something good to prevent illegal.
Apprehensions are an indicator of total attempts to cross the border. So the more apprehensions you have, the more total attempts you have to cross the border illegally. The fewer apprehensions you have, that means the fewer attempts people are making to cross the border illegally. I should have made that clear at the outset.
So are you on an island, Jay? Because on the one hand—
No, that's my point. I'm not on an island. The majority of the American public believes that. But the majority view gets shouted out by the politicians in Washington who are screaming from the extreme right and the extreme left.
When you describe this now, and I've seen you both on, I don't know if it was CNN or MSNBC and Fox News.
I work both sides of the street,
right?
Literally.
Both sides of the street.
30 Rock and 1211 Sixth Avenue, both sides of the street.
One is closer to Paul Weiss than the other.
No, actually, they're about the same. They're about the same distance.
Yeah. Well placed, Paul Weiss. That, of course, is Secretary Johnson's law firm. My point is, when you describe that tenure, it seems so controversial now. Yet in your period, those 8 years of the Obama administration, and I'm talking about in the climate of a Democratic primary, you know, to say what you're saying, I mean, you're it was hard to get Joe Biden to say this, as far as I recall.
Well, part of it is reflective of the period where we are now. Immigration has become an even more volatile subject in the Trump presidency than it was during the Obama presidency. Tempers are so frayed. Debates are so heated around an issue where there are answers that can be achieved. It's just that they're unachievable politically. There are answers. There is a way to secure our border. I'm quite sure that the border security experts within DHS have in their top desk drawer a plan for securing our border. But the issue has become so politicized and so toxic that we can't get anything done. It used to be as recently as 5-6 years ago, Roger, that there was a recognition here in Washington that if you wanted to have comprehensive immigration reform, you needed to embrace two poles. One pole being taking care of the people who are already here, who have been here for years, who present no threat. The core of that group are the dreamers, the kids who came here as kids. Mm-hmm. You needed to take care of them, but we also needed to have a secure border. We had to do the things more to secure our border, and that any comprehensive immigration reform plan had to encompass both. Now, given where the politics are, you have people screaming from the extreme right or screaming from the extreme left without any recognition of the other side's point of view.
We'll bring a little Reagan in here, because the last time there was comprehensive immigration reform was during the Reagan administration, the Simpson-Mazzola Act. And conservatives now, and I think it happened
politically, it was a very different time and a different place, unfortunately.
And George W. Bush tried to do this. And at that time, is the way people viewed the history of the Reagan Immigration Act was that the second piece that you described was never put in place, whereas the amnesty part went in there, but the other piece of it, you know, basically, they never got there.
Your Republican stripes are coming out, Roger.
Well, no, I'm asking you to comment on that.
A very pejorative term, amnesty, to describe deferred action for those who are here undocumented. Okay.
But that was that the way it was described. The story is that it came late, that the border security piece never in place. If we did it again and that was corrected, do you think there'd be a political opportunity to realize immigration reform?
Well, as you recall, it passed the Senate 68 votes. That's a lot of Republicans and a lot of Democrats. And it failed in the House in the summer of 2014, unfortunately. So as recently as 5-6 years ago, there were a lot of Republicans prepared to step up to this. And it is not dissimilar to what we talked about earlier with national security. Comprehensive immigration reform, in my view, needs to start from the center and work its way out. The problem is, politically, no one is willing to exercise the political courage to do that because they're worried about being primaried from the extreme right or the extreme left.
So, and they've gone to the courts now, right? So at least in the case of the Dreamers, curious what your take is on that.
The courts can't be the answer
argument
for every political logjam.
But their Supreme Court is entertaining the case now. So whether or not the Trump administration's attempt to do away with the President Obama's executive order for DACA, and we'll see what the court says. What do you think of that argument?
Which argument?
The argument before the court to challenge President Trump's ability.
Well, I have to disclose I'm an amicus in that case. I filed an amicus brief in defense of the Dreamers, along with other former DHS officials.
That the president shouldn't be able then to, with the stroke of a pen, remove the executive order.
This is where, if they had a chance to do something over again, they ought to take it. DACA is a policy. By definition, a policy can be undone by a president. It's executive action. So, you know, you start a policy, you can end a policy. But rather than say, I don't like the policy, therefore I'm ending it, President Trump deferred to his attorney general, who said, the policy is unlawful, therefore I must end it. My hands are tied. And when he did that, he invited the judiciary in lawsuits to second guess that judgment. And that's where we are. So
there's a line in here between
from discontinuing a policy.
Secretary Jay Johnson and one of the trustees of the Reagan Foundation, Ted Olson, who has argued the case on behalf of the Dreamers before the Supreme Court. It strikes me, though, that that's not the best way. It is a far from the best way to address this policy question, but having the courts come in here and weigh in. I get it that the president turned to the attorney general.
Why this president doesn't embrace comprehensive immigration reform, give Republicans in Congress the top cover to take care of the Dreamers, and at the same time build more border security, and have his Nixon goes to China moment on immigration reform, and then have legitimate bragging rights that he was able to do something that his predecessor was not. Why he doesn't do that is a mystery to me.
If it's a second term, or one of the Democratic candidates is elected to president, you think we'll see something like that after 2020?
Well, if it's a second Trump term, I think he has so poisoned the well on this and other topics that it's difficult to imagine any Democrat wanting to give him that political victory. But all I'll say is that there are answers to our broken immigration system. There are common sense, apolitical answers to fixing our broken immigration system. And this was a coalition 5-6 years ago for immigration reform that included organized labor, Chamber of Commerce, and a very, very broad coalition of people. And why we could not get it done is most unfortunate.
Let's shift to another challenging issue on the minds of Americans. You dealt with it in depth as Secretary of Homeland Security, and then we'll have to wrap up this session. But both as your time as General Counsel, and then as Secretary of Homeland Security, General Counsel, Department of Defense, Secretary of Homeland Security afterwards, the challenges posed by cyber attacks and the vulnerability of our networks in this country really kind of rose to the forefront of our national security agencies and really in the minds of Americans. We just recently completed here at the Reagan Institute a national survey where, once again, 2 years running, the threat of cyber attacks ranked number one in the minds of Americans, the things they were concerned about in terms of national security threats. It's kitchen table stuff.
It is, yes, because I think Americans are beginning to understand the nature of the threat.
They see it with every major breach of some
They've
company.
Had their personal data stolen,
correct.
Right?
You and I have had letters from the Office of Personnel and Management informing us that a foreign actor
has our SF-86.
Has our security clearance forms. Where are we now with that? And then, of course, the biggest example, the one that's driving and at the forefront of the impeachment proceedings down the street here on Pennsylvania Avenue, is tied up with cyber as well in terms of interference in our elections. Where are we now, Jay, and particularly when it comes to elections? Are we in a better place in 2020 than we were in 2016?
Okay, so you have to look at it in terms of buckets. I characterize the cyber threat to our democracy in three, I put it in three buckets. One is the potential attack on election infrastructure. And I'll give a good report here. I think over the last 3 years, a lot of good work has been done between state election officials and the Department of Homeland Security to better secure election infrastructure from an attack on, say, voter registration list or election machinery. Bucket two are hacks into campaigns, like the DNC attack we saw in 2016. I think there the campaigns are uneven in terms of their own cybersecurity. Some, probably the better financed campaigns, are paying some attention to this. Others are probably not.
You mean when they get money from donors, they're not taking, you know, 20% of it and making sure that the emails are secure?
There actually is. I'm going to give a plug for something called US Cyberdome. I'm on their board of advisors. It's a not-for-profit that is offering its cybersecurity expertise free to every campaign on both sides of the aisle.
Are candidates using it?
I hope some. I believe some. That's a work in progress. The hardest nut to crack is the fake news bucket.
No, I've heard of that term, but what do you mean in this context?
I mean the publication and republication by foreign government actors of fake news to affect public opinion in terms of the candidates for election.
Talk to me about tech companies who want no part in excising fake news from their social media platforms.
Okay, well, before I talk about the tech companies, I have to make a point.
Okay.
In order to effectively deal with nation state actors who attack in cyberspace our democracy, you cannot have a complete 100% line of defense. The only way to stop the Russians from interfering in our democracy again is to create a sufficient deterrent, to make the behavior cost prohibitive, and to send the unequivocal message to the Russian government, we will not tolerate this. That message right now is being undermined by talk of how, hey, maybe the Ukrainians did it and not the Russians. That waters down, that undermines the very message that even the Trump administration has been trying to send for the last 3 years. And so this emerging theory that somehow it was the Ukrainians and not the Russians, I think, sets back our democracy and gives actually the Russian government comfort that if they do this again, there will not be a sufficient deterrent. So when it comes to fake news and the publication, republication of fake news and extremist views, it is and has been my view that government agencies, particularly security agencies of our government, should not be involved in trying to regulate political speech and to regulate content in debate. We are a free society that guarantees free speech. Think of the misuse of the authority that we could give to an executive to ban something that they deem fake news. I believe that first and foremost, it has to be up to internet service providers, social media providers, to better insist on attribution and to regulate content that violates their very own terms of use. Obviously, that's a bit like chasing ghosts. It's a bit like chasing rabbits. But
you realize the skepticism people have for the ability to enforce your terms of use of, let's say, a tech company.
I understand.
Would probably equal people's skepticism of allowing an executive in the White House regulate.
Our virtue as a free and open society where the government does not edit our speech is also our principal vulnerability when it comes to our democracy. And with the internet now, there are a plethora of ways in which Americans can receive information, which far too often is simply an exercise in seeking out sources of information that reaffirms your own biases and prejudices already. So I think it first and foremost has to be up to internet service providers to better regulate what is on their platforms.
Bottom line though, are we better off and better prepared in 2020 than we were in 2016?
Yes. Bottom line, net, I would say yes.
All right, we have gone over from the allotted time for this podcast. This has been a great conversation, and I have a gazillion more questions that I would love to explore with you, but we'll wait for when you come back to the podcast. But we'll close out the way we do each of these sessions, which is, could you share with us your favorite Reagan quote, book, or speech, or anything of the like?
Yes, two things come to mind. Well, three things. One, President Reagan's style of leadership. He had his core beliefs, his core principles. He knew where he wanted to go, but he was also not afraid to compromise when he saw that it was necessary to compromise in order to get stuff done. and conveyed an optimism about the future of this country that was contagious. The thing that Reagan said, which I think was his last national address, as I recall, was a comment on who we are as a nation of immigrants. And it's hard to believe many politicians saying this now, which was, and I'm not going to get the words exactly right, you can migrate to France and never be French. Mm-hmm. You can migrate to Germany and never be German. You can go to Great Britain and never be British. But if you migrate to America, you become an American, or at least you have the possibility of becoming an American. And that was the greatness of our country. And Ronald Reagan said that. I happen to believe the best speech I ever saw Ronald Reagan give, I didn't agree with everything he said, but I thought the best speech, which was probably one of the best inaugural addresses I ever saw, was his first inaugural in 1981. I saw it in person at the invitation of Congressman Hamilton Fish.
Back to where we started,
who asked me to come to the Reagan inaugural in 1981. As you recall, although you're probably too young to recall, that was a big day because it was also the day that the Iranian hostages were released. But I thought Reagan gave a really powerful address that day. It was the first one on the Western front of the Capitol. I was at Jimmy Carter's 4 years before. And I thought he gave a really powerful address with a very clear message.
Secretary Johnson, thank you so much for coming on the Reaganism podcast. You're welcome back anytime.
Thanks for having me.